Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Dispatches. Tonight, we have with us Mr. John Weber, who is the Administrative Director of the Religious Studies Department at Naropa University. He's also quite an accomplished graphic designer, and as I introduced him to somebody that's not even part of the Shambhala Mandala about a week ago, and I said, he's the guy with the pins. He's the pin man. So if you ever wonder where many of these pins came from, there are many other people involved, but John was one of the main pin men. So welcome, John.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. And by the way, here is in the Dorje Kasson office of the Shambhala Center in Boulder at probably 6:30 in the evening, so it's dark. Welcome again. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this path, when you met Trungpa Rinpoche, how you became a practitioner?
I went to school in Boulder in 1970, and my grandparents and parents had been going to school here, so I was bound and determined to come here as well, which I did. And partway through my school year, I read this book called Be Here Now. And that was fascinating to me. I became really involved with Swami Satchidananda, who taught here in Boulder at that time. He would visit, and I would go up and I would meditate in 1111 Pearl, which was Swami Satchidananda's center at that time.
Really?
Just part of it. We didn't have the whole thing. We just had part of it. And I would go there, and he would come through, and I'd see him once in a while. And I thought he was a great, great man. But after a while, I was 19 at the time, so it was hard for me to wear white and be celibate and not eat meat. And so I realized I wasn't cut out for the spiritual path, or so I thought. So I kind of backed away from it and went back to school at CU. And then one day, a woman came up to me, a friend of mine, and said, I have this Tibetan Buddhism class I don't want. Do you want to take it? It's a drop-ad day, you know. And I had this great hesitation, and I said to her, I've tried spirituality, and it didn't really work for me. But I took the card anyway, ad card for Tibetan Buddhism. And it was a nighttime class, we can imagine. It was taught by Trungpa Rinpoche. This was probably 1973. And we were all the students gathered there in the evening, and Rinpoche...
How many students?
Probably a room full, maybe... 40.
This is your typical class.
Yeah, at CU. And we were all kind of raucous and so on. And I was kind of sitting towards the back because there were no seats in the front. And all of us, several people I'd been to high school with were even in the class. And we were all being kind of raucous. And I think it's an urban myth, right, that if the teacher's so late, you can leave the class, like it's 10 minutes or 20 minutes. And so we were all saying, the teacher is 15 minutes late, we could leave, but we didn't because we just were curious. And finally he came walking in, and it was like 20 minutes late, and it was hilarious to us. We thought, the absent-minded professor or something. So we all burst into laughter when he walked in because it was so late. And so surprising to us, he burst into laughter as well. And he's laughing all the way up as he slowly walks up and takes a seat in front of the class. And then we kind of stop laughing. But he keeps on laughing. That was kind of odd, disconcerting. And he's like really laughing. And then I got a little scared because he was like really laughing. And I thought I knew what the joke was, but suddenly it seemed like he knew what the joke was and I didn't. So that was kind of my first experience of the scary joke of Trungpa Rinpoche. And that's kind of what the whole class ended up being, that kind of humor and fear at the same time, that entire class.
And did you have a textbook?
Yes, we had several textbooks. However, the first one was Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And all I could do was read that book the whole semester. I couldn't read any more books than that because that was so like...
Enough.
Devastating, or atomic bomb to me. And I went to my TA, who was Bill Indich, and said, I can't read any more of the books than this class. This is all I can read. He said, that's fine. Just read that book.
To his credit,
that was great.
Did you have an exam?
I don't remember. I do remember at the end thinking, ah, oh, I've finally gotten through this class. I made it, you know. And then kind of towards the end, Rinpoche said, I'm starting a new college down the road, and you're all welcome to come down and join me. And then again, the scary joke continued, like, oh, my gosh, would I, you know, leave CU and go and join him at this new college? He was standing down the hill, starting down the hill.
What was your major at CU?
Fine arts.
Fine arts, so you've always had an artistic background.
Yeah. My grandmother would take me out painting to New Mexico as a young man, and in Colorado, if you could draw things realistically, then you were an artist. It wasn't too sophisticated out here at that time.
Like those things, is can your child draw this Bambi?
Yeah, well, it wasn't even Bambi. I could draw people and make them, you know, or face look like a face. So I was an artist, just like my grandmother. And so we were classified as the artists. And
did you go to the other little college? Did you go to his university down the street?
Yeah, Ram Dass and Rinpoche went there. Well, every summer we went for the first few years, living here in Boulder.
And what were you taking? What were you particularly attracted to?
I just took his main course. And it wasn't until, well, I taught a little bit as adjunct faculty at Naropa, I think, extended studies and with Valerie Sanford in a Buddhist meditation class. But I never really had a connection to Naropa until I went back to school there in 2001. And after having, you know, various graphic design firms and so forth, I decided to drop things and go back to Naropa, take a Master of Divinity degree, go for my Master of Divinity degree, which was a 3-year degree, and the end view being that you would become an interfaith chaplain and work with people in hospitals or prisons. My idea was that I would teach people meditation in prisons or various situations like that. I just felt like I wanted to do something more directly in contact with people. I don't know.
And what actually happened in that degree? What did you study? How did it push your boundaries? How did it prepare you to do what you wanted to do?
Well, I was 50 at the time. I had continued my little meditation practice. I'm kind of a slow learner, so I have a literal approach, and I practice maybe 4 or 5 times a week. And I thought that I didn't think I was going to learn that much particularly. But I was surprised. My mind was blown. I was put through a vegetable grinder equal to that of my first seminary.
By what?
By just the process of going to Naropa, taking the classes, learning new things. I found, again, the hunger and the joy in learning, that kind of passion, that kind of high we get from learning things. From opening up and learning new things. It's actually kind of high that can carry you for a while. I wrote, I think, 47 papers my first semester. So that was intense. That kind of intellectual rigor brought back that I definitely lost for a while there. But it blew my mind in a very fundamental way. And part of it was, there's many aspects to that degree. Part of it was learning about other religious traditions. Part of it was learning a little bit of psychology. Part of it was learning societal issues. And part of it was counseling skills. And I think I'll just maybe talk about a couple of them tonight, because we don't have that much time. But I'll start out with the other religious tradition situation. And this was something that was started by Trungpa Rinpoche. Early on, when he met, from my understanding, when he met Thomas Merton, and then Thomas Merton died, and he had vowed to continue with this connection he had with Thomas Merton. So he started something called the Buddhist-Christian Dialogue, and he got Reggie Ray and Judith Zimmer Brown to sign on and work with this situation. And some of these dialogues are very mind-blowing. That, you know, Trungpa would make jokes at community talks maybe about Jesus or something. And from that, I implied that he was panning Christianity or other religions. But seeing the things that he's talked about in these Buddhist-Christian dialogues has really opened me up. It's really just the profundity of these other traditions.
What sorts of issues really impacted you?
I think one was the profundity of the contemplative traditions. of the other religions. And you can actually read some of these dialogue talks in the book Speaking of Silence, which is published by Shambhala Publications. The profundity of these other traditions and some quality of that the world is just much more fascinating, much more fun, when you haven't pinned it down with what you know about everything. That you may not have all the answers, and it's sure a hell of a lot more fun and interesting, and it keeps you awake if when you encounter somebody, you don't think that they don't know what it's about, and you do know what it's about. So that's one of the main things that this going to Naropa taught me at my old dog stage, that I could learn new tricks. And I got addicted to this not knowing. And that's one of the key points in interreligious chaplaincy, that's, you knock on a door, like we used to do with Rinpoche, and we bowed with Rinpoche. Here you just knock on the door and you walk in, and actually the worldly wisdom at this point with clinical pastoral education is that you click into that not knowing as much as you can. You don't come from anywhere. You don't dare try to proselytize. But you walk in and you listen and you learn. We're getting into counseling techniques now, counseling skills, and they really teach you the magic of listening. And pretty soon, because your nose has been held to the grindstone of working in the hospital or the prison or wherever you work, suddenly you find that you're fascinated by listening to people. You're addicted to listening to people. You're more curious about what they think than about what you think. And then Sacred World becomes really starts to open up, and you really begin to, the line in the Sadhana Mahamudra that says, the phenomenal world is all the books I need, begins to take on new meaning. You know, I can remember the various... Well, after, so you to do your MDiv degree there at Naropa, and then to become a chaplain, you have to do an internship, which I did for a year at Boulder Community Hospital.
Is this for a legal chaplaincy?
Yeah.
So you actually have a license and you can call yourself an interfaith chaplain?
Board certification.
Is it a state-based?
National.
National.
Yeah. And so you do your internship, and then you have to do your residency. And I did my residency in the hood of Philadelphia, West Philly, at UPenn Hospital there. And my wife and daughter stayed here in Boulder. Well, I went there for about 11 months and did that. But because your nose is held to that grindstone of listening to person after person, suddenly something sticks. And suddenly the sacred world opens up and you begin to see these people. Maybe it starts with... Who knows what it starts with, but you notice gestures of helplessness, or you notice a twinkle in the eye, or you notice a certain nuance. Let me talk about this a little more deeply. So as our deep contemplative training as Buddhists, and maybe other traditions have this as well, but as Buddhists, we're taught to let go. And this training is that you walk into, and you're walking into somebody, you knock on the door, you walk in, and you're willing to go into the unknown, and it's a very sweaty, palm-type situation. And you don't know what's going to go on. And usually they have some horrific disease. This willing to be in the unknown, if you're a Buddhist and you are practicing, suddenly this letting go goes into kind of a second step of losing the separation between yourself and the other person for moments. Maybe a moment here, a moment there. And suddenly, you are experiencing what the other person is experiencing for maybe a moment or two. There's just no separation. The other person, for some reason, I don't know why, feels that you're experiencing the same thing. Maybe they feel it as no judgment. Maybe they feel it as a moment of non-duality themselves. Who knows? But there's some little liberation that happens if you do it right. They don't seem to have to do it right. Just one person seems to have to be able to not separate. And in that space, you don't have to have a strategy. And maybe they're encountering for the first time somebody who's not manipulating what they're saying. And therefore, it liberates. There's some kind of healing that happens in their pain if nobody's trying to make them not have pain somehow.
And how do you deal with your discomfort?
label it thinking, and on, all the way up to self-liberation, or liberating by itself, and everything in between. Depends on where you are at the moment.
And that is the contemplative training.
Yeah, or maybe you just have to label and say, I'm very uncomfortable right now. And then that person just helped you, because they were there with, you know, all kinds of things. But basically, I mean, the idea of you going in there to help them is questionable. And as I found often, you know, it's a mutual help, and often they helped me more than I helped them, probably. But who knows?
And how could you tell that there was, for lack of a better word, progress? Not just in your relationship of intimacy and trust with this person, but in their own relationship to the difficult vicissitudes of their life.
Some kind of tone, smile when you left, or some kind of mostly a tremendous amount of physical touch in the situation. Luckily, we don't have to be politically correct like doctors do. Somehow chaplains had this, or nurses have to be more politically correct there with touch and tell them. Somehow chaplains got away with it, and we were, you know, holding hands or stroking arms or faces all the time. Or at least I was. And people said that was... And, you know, you have a lot of guidelines, and chaplains, it was okay to do that for some reason. For better or for worse, but it was good with me. It was lucky with me.
So there is a place for a kind of directness and non-conceptual transmission of well-being.
On an outer level, what you learn, you know, you learn to work with kind of modular components of spirituality when you start studying other traditions and see the same thing from another point of view. So one thing you're thinking with is conceptuality and non-conceptuality. And when somebody's kind of being non-conceptual and they're dying, you want them to be in the zone, so to speak, because something seems to work in the zone. I remember, you know, the Christianity I discovered there in the hood in Philadelphia and West Philly in the hospital was not a Eurocentric Christianity. It was a black, people of color Christianity that was nothing I had ever encountered growing up as a Methodist Episcopalian. I'd walk in, I'd think of one particular, several, but I'll think of one particular black woman who I went to the room, and there was a glow in the room. She was dying. And she was definitely more concerned about me than she was about her. You know, how was I handling it? Was I okay? And that wasn't a big deal, but it was a concern of hers, you know. And this is what I call somebody who was in the zone, definitely, you know. And it's nothing that I would try and mess with. When somebody's dying, they don't fake their religion. Some people did, and it didn't work. They, you know, some people tried to bring things to bear, and it wasn't holding water, and they were in trouble. But other people didn't. I can think of a lot of this black Christianity where there was something going on there that I could only touch with a non-conceptual reference point. Other situations where I would, you know, work with that. I'm thinking of one where it was, you know, Trauma Bay, in the Trauma Bay where there's a lot of horrific situations going on, and one very religious black woman went to see her son who'd been to the ICU unit moved upstairs, and they just had this large prayer group, and it's, you know, again, something we're not used to with Eurocentric Christianity, a large vocal prayer group, and then the daughter arrived who had just converted to black Muslim in the last 4 years or so, daughter-in-law, and the son was the one who was in the hospital. Well, as soon as the mother sees the daughter, she runs towards her and starts grabbing her hair and pulling her hair out, trying to pull out her hair. Again, another cultural situation, very demonstrative culture. Demonstrative in a way that I didn't have a handle on. So I'm trying to separate them.
Pull out her hair because...
Rip out her hair because she's a Muslim and she converted her son to a Muslim.
So she lost her son.
She lost her son from Christianity to Islam. just trying to pull out the daughter-in-law's hair. They're spinning around. I'm alone in a hallway with them at 2 in the morning. And then one starts screaming, I've got a knife. So I'm trying to, the mother's trying to pull out the daughter's hair. I'm trying to work in a conceptual way. And I said, trying to remember your compassion, a Christian compassion. She's been praying about that. She said, I don't have to have compassion because this woman is a Muslim. So that wasn't working. And so then I just went to the zone myself and I started saying the Lord's Prayer in the mother's ear. And she let go in about 4 seconds. So that kind of...
direct transmission to her.
Mm-hmm. Like learning these kind of modular components of spirituality and how to work with that.
And how about, did anybody ever challenge you and say, do you believe in God? And how did they respond to that?
All the time. And Zigar Khonkhar Rinpoche, who I studied with for 2 or 3 years, gave me some great advice there. He said, if I was said to him, well, isn't Jesus Christ like maybe perhaps a fourth level bodhisattva because he could walk on water? And he said, that's the wrong approach to take, John. If you want to connect people to Jesus Christ, you have to go to the Dharmakaya, connect his living manifestation, and bring that down for them. Don't try and do it the conceptual way. So from that point of view, I mean, you could say Vajradhara, in a way, is a type of God for us Buddhists. The lineage is a type of God for us Buddhists. Emptiness is a type of God for us Buddhists. Impermanence, the three marks of existence. That's reality. And a lot of these contemplative traditions, that's reality is God. That's what we're talking about here. So you could go into that in detail or not, depending on the situation, the skillful means of the situation. Other times you might just say yes.
But did you lose your credibility with people because you could not attest to your faith in terms of God?
No. Again, you use the skillful means of the situation. I mean, on a very inner level, it came down to this. I remember one time you may not see how this has anything to do with it, but I'm going to talk about this. It's an inner level. A man with a horrible throat cancer. I walk into his room. This throat cancer is like the things you see in a hospital. It's like, you know, open wound, pus, oozing, this kind of thing. And tremendous fear in his eyes. So I walk up, and he, at least, you know, I get up close, and that's maybe more than a lot of people did. But what he does is grabs my shirt collar and pulls me down within 2 inches of his face. Now I can smell it, and smell is my thing. Something smells gross, and I really have a problem. So I contract, and then something deep in my training reminds me to let go. So I let go, and we stay there for maybe 8 to 10 minutes, and letting go second by second, disowning second by second. What it comes down to is, if are you afraid to die? Are you afraid to let go? The same thing. Can you let go? Can you die? And that level, and that intensity of that death, that's what it comes down to. Can you let go of all the scariness and be? So he's looking right in your eyes. He's pulling you down. He's looking in your eyes. If you can let go in your eyes, if you can die, then he can die. It's okay for you to be with it. He can be with it. It's okay for you to let go. He can let go. I don't know why that happens, but it happens. Finally, after about 8 minutes, he relaxed, let go of my collar. And then I looked over and I saw his sister was sitting in the room, kind of cowering in the corner. I hadn't even known she was there. But the intensity of the exchange had just, you know, she just had shriveled up into the corner, basically. So that's the first level. Then you can talk about, do you believe in God, or that kind of thing. But you have to be at the first level before they even register the reality of your second level. That, you know, in the hospital, it's kind of that kind of thing. You can say blah, 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 but your being has to be there. It's genuine. And they see that when they're dying.
The training that you get at Naropa, and the training, is it, you must have colleagues that come to get trained, other students that come to get trained, that come from a variety of religious traditions. In some ways, this whole notion of letting go and nowness and so on is very much part of the Buddhist tradition. How did you learn, how did you discover that in other traditions? Because they have, must be inherently there. We just never knew about it because we never studied it.
Yeah. Well, one thing is you learn skillful techniques in dialogue. And first you go out and you talk to people from other traditions. You open up to them. And then you learn techniques with talking with them. Judith Zimmer Brown has been the kind of carrier, the holder of the torch of interfaith dialogue that Rinpoche has passed on for years and years. And things we learn are you could have an attitude of exclusivity, which would be that my understanding of reality is the only understanding of reality that really works on this planet. Everything else is bogus. Then there's the idea of inclusivity, which is everything is basically okay as long as they come under my tent and basically have the same paradigm or general framework of reality that I have. Come aboard. Welcome, everybody, all traditions, as long as the general framework is the same. As long as you basically believe like I do in a general way. And the last is called pluralism, which is the idea that when you listen to somebody, when you speak with somebody, you're willing to have your idea of reality change, to have it grow, change, or whatever. So this is the idea of interfaith dialogue or talking to people. So that's the first step, talk to them. Another thing, in Reb Zalman's classes, we would go out and we'd have to visit 7 other congregations of our choice, and you just go there. I went to a Baptist, I went to a Hasidic Jewish tradition, I went to Sufi one. I went to Jodu Shinshu in Denver, a great big church there. And it was great, you know, it's just amazing. The point is just to do something about it. You know, don't sit at home with your ideas about things. Yeah, go and actually talk to people and see what they really believe.
Be an armchair warrior and expect reality to arrive in the mail.
Yeah.
What is the role of joy and creativity in your work?
Well, I've done all these, hospital things. Then I came back to Boulder. I had to get a job, so I started working with Boulder County Hospice. And I needed a full-time job. They had a half-time job, and they kept saying, hang in here, we're going to get it to you. Just our census isn't up. They didn't have enough people dying yet to give me a full-time job. And then Naropa University called me up and said, oh, we have this position. Would you please consider taking it? It's a full-time job. So I did. I didn't have much choice at that point. And that job is so horrendous. I thought the trauma bay in the hood of West Philly was hard this time.
It smells worse.
It's harder for me right now. So that's a good question. I'm looking for joy now. You know, where's the joy?
And how do you work with your own joy as a gift to other people?
Yeah. Well, when I was talking to these people, you know, it was, I'd have to talk about personal practice, formal practice. You know, that's where my joy comes from. Resting in the nature of my own mind, or I could say resting in discursive thought itself, opens up a very unconditional space. Resting in basic cognizance, resting in fundamental knowing. For some reason, this just makes things fresh and like seeing something for the first time. And that's where joy comes from for me. I can remember looking out the window in my second grade car trip to California with my parents. And that was pure joy, never seeing a palm tree or the ocean before. And that's very vivid. And, you know, when I rest in
the eyes of
original mind, that's what it is, fresh, seeing things for the first time. Because they are seeing for the first time.
You know, in some ways, probably that is the core key teaching of Trungpa Rinpoche.
Yeah. Well, another key teaching of his was this, and my wife said this to me last night. It's very interesting. I was feeling particularly trapped last night. I'm doing course scheduling now and a bunch of things at work. It's really tight. And my daughter has homework, and it's my turn to help her with it. And my wife has a full-time job, and I'm just completely trapped right now in terms of no space in my life. I have a 10-year-old at 54. It's kind of ridiculous. And we both have full-time jobs. So she's calling right now. Anyway, she says to me, honey.
Is it her?
Yeah, but I told her I was going to do that. She said, honey, you know, you're not trapped. And I thought right away, I am trapped. And then Rinpoche came to my mind. And I realized, this is kind of how we work together, my wife and I, we, one person would say one thing that helps you all the way, but they catalyze something. I realized, I thought, I am trapped. And then I thought, the only reason, the only way that you're going to realize freedom from being trapped is by being trapped. You know, the only way you realize space from being trapped is by being trapped itself. Then you realize there's no trap. If you don't realize there's no trap unless you're trapped. And I think that was Rinpoche's real teaching. He created the most intense situations for us. And by those intense situations, we would see the space there. So,
the contrast.
I don't know. I think it's more self-liberation. Liberating by itself. That's how it works for me. Well, didn't Kensi Rinpoche say something like, the way you know you've made any progress on the past is if you can handle difficult situations? And so I think that's what Trump Rinpoche was doing by, you know, creating these claustrophobic situations for us by being, you can't realize that you can get out of a trap unless you're trapped.
I want to thank you for being here with us and for telling us such an amazing story about leaping and going forward and putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. And actually practicing the path for the sake of all sentient beings and having a big feast.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Let's have a good time.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
This is a story from the 10th anniversary of Karma Trolling. So this was 1980, and we made a big deal out of the karma trolling. We set up great pavilions in the Upper Meadow and hung banners and designed banners and erected orange torii gates against the dark green pine trees and had wonderful Japanese lanterns hanging in the pavilions that would kind of waft in the wind as the evening breeze blew. And this was around early summer. I remember looking up to the pavilion on that summer evening, and Rinpoche was sitting there in his white Abhisheka uniform, and Lady Diana was next to him, and Gesar, and the regent. I can't remember if Lady Rich was there or not, but one thing I remember was the white Japanese lanterns, as they were swaying, were getting these black spots on them, large black spots. And I was a kusing at that time, so I could look closely, and I saw, oh, they're actually kind of dark reddish-brown spots, and they saw there were big beetles, which were in fact June bugs. So Geisa was also fascinated by this phenomenon, the June bugs alighting on these huge white paper Japanese lanterns that were kind of the most illuminated thing around, swaying in the breeze. And so he went up and tried to pull these June bugs off of the paper. And I was standing right behind the Bijatara, and he said, Geisa, be careful that you don't injure the June bugs' feet, because they have these little kind of hooked feet that go into the paper, and if you pull them off too quickly, it will tear their feet. So you do it very gently, and you let them know you're taking them off, and then they'll let go by themselves, and it won't hurt their feet. And obviously I'm thinking, how does Rinpoche, you know this? But I suppose it was kind of an intuitive thing. At any rate, Gesar collected a whole jar of June bugs. And these are about, oh, if you've ever seen a June bug, you know, they're probably 2.5 to 3 inches long. And being from Colorado, we don't have bugs that big. We don't have East Coast bugs out here. So they're kind of horrific to me, these big old June bugs. They're big beetles, and they're dark reddish brown. So Gesar took the jar of June bugs back to the house, Bhumipali Bhavan, you know, over the hill from Karma Trolling. And we kusing and servers were serving a formal dinner there. It was quite a big formal dinner because, you know, everyone was there and it was the 10th anniversary. And we really tried to pull out all the stops and make it as really grand as possible. And it was. But at one point, Rinpoche asked me to clear a dish, which I was confused about. It was a covered dish. And he said, please take this to the kitchen. We're finished with it. Which didn't quite fit in our serving order, so I was a little confused. But I cleared it, obviously. I took it to the kitchen, and just placed it down. And then one of the female servers happened to open up the top of the dish, and the June bugs, all the June bugs started crawling out of the dish. And she screamed, you know, and other everybody, you know, a lot of people screamed. I didn't scream, but a lot of people screamed. And, you know, then we heard howls from the dining room as this, as the kitchen screamed. Well, then, of course, we figured out ways to surreptitiously get the June bugs back into the living room several times, you know, during the serving them as one of the courses several times during the evening. And then the only one who would scream in the living room was Lady Diana, basically. So that went back and forth for a little bit. But then much, much later tonight, way later in the night, Lady Diana had gone to bed. And Rinpoche decided that he wanted her to come back down again. So he had the Kusin call her, and finally she came back down. It was probably 3 a.m. at this point. And she came down and said, What is it? What did you want? And he just smiled. And she said, what? And he smiled larger. He said, what is it that you want? And he smiled larger and larger. And then he opened his mouth a little bit, and you saw first little tiny feet come over his bottom teeth, and then antenna come over his bottom teeth. And then eventually he opened his mouth all the way, and probably, I would say, 8 June bugs started crawling out of his mouth.
The lion's vein spreads turquoise clouds, Garuda spans the threefold world. Fearless the warriors of Shambhala, majestic the Rigdons on Vajra thrones.
The Sakya king joins heaven and earth,
the Sakya one more harvest beast. The trumpet of fearlessness resounds, the old victorious banner flies. Temporal and spiritual glorious band, rejoice the great eastern sun arises. Rejoice the great eastern sun arises. Rejoice the great eastern sun.